come now to oral questions. The first in the name of the Right Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does he stand by all of his government's statements and actions?
Yes, and in particular, I stand by the government's phone away for the day policy, which is so popular with parents and students and schools, and with great feedback from people like the Hornby High School head boy, Kush Patel, who said, "The ban has helped students focus more academically." Cameron Stone, the principal of Stratford High School in the Mighty Whanganui electorate, he said it's an awesome, overwhelming success for us. And Mr Speaker, I have to say I am proud to lead a government that makes the changes that we need to ensure our kids are well set up for a great future, because we're getting our country back on track.
Well done. It's worth noting that when you watch this replay on TV, this person speaking is clearly audible with a bit of mumble in the background. So most of that is denying the House an answer as opposed to the general public. Call on the Right Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Point of order.
I suspect there would have been a little less noise had half of the government benches not been looking at their phones during the Prime Minister's answer.
Well, that's an interesting point, but not a point of order.
All right then. Supplementary, Mr Speaker.
Sorry? Point of order?
If the House didn't hear it, I'm happy to repeat it. They're my answer.
Thank you for your generous offer. I'm not interested in hearing it again. So can we please have the supplementary from the Right Honourable Chris Hipkins?
What will the average weekly cost be to families due to the government's decision to no longer fund half-price public transport for people under the age of 25?
It depends on their circumstances, but if a member would like to put the question in writing, we'll get him a proper answer.
Why isn't he aware that using the National Party's own tax cut calculator, someone in their early 20s that takes the bus each day and earns the average wage could be worse off by more than $70 a fortnight as a result of that change?
Well, look, I thank the member for their concern about that constituent, but what I'd say is that help is on the way, because we are going to deliver low and middle income tax relief to hard-working Kiwis. These are the people that the Labor Party used to care about but have long forgotten.
Is he aware that parents will now need to pay more to get their under-13s to school as a result of that change, while his government is also threatening to cut the school lunch program that could see those same parents $33 a week per child worse off?
I'd just say to that member, again, help is on the way to lower middle-income New Zealanders doing it tough in a cost-of-living crisis created by that member's previous government.
Supplementary, right on Winston Peters.
But I asked the Prime Minister as to whether people in Auckland would be catching the bus each day if light rail had been built as Labor promised.
Now that's one of those interventions that is interesting but not worthy of a question.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker.
Well, unless you've got responsibility for the failure of a previous policy, I don't think so. Right Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Will the $2.9 billion of tax cuts for landlords result in lower rents, given Trade Me reporting that rents have surged 8.3% since last year?
This government is committed to putting downward pressure on rents, and we are bringing the bright line test back from 10 to 2 years. We're making sure we restore interest deductibility and we get the balance of laws right between tenants and landlords. But what I'd say to that member is we are not going to see $170 per week increase in rents as we saw under his administration.
Question. So will rents decrease as a result of his government's tax cuts for landlords?
The series of actions we're taking in the rental market will put downward pressure on rents.
Supplementary question. What does he think best reflects his promised laser-like commitment to tackling the cost of living? Higher public transport costs, his government's new driver's tax, higher costs for prescriptions, higher rents, higher fuel prices, higher rates, lower pay increases or higher unemployment?
Well, I can tell you there is a series of things that this government is doing to focus on lowering the cost of living and lowering inflation. We've got the Reserve Bank focused on a single target of fighting inflation. We've actually made sure we've introduced our family boost policy to give families that are struggling with childhood costs some support and subsidy. We're making sure that we're going to give tax relief in this budget for low and middle income working New Zealanders. We're serious about lowering inflation, and isn't it good that inflation hit 4%, the lowest it's been for 3 years? We're on our way.
Question number two, in the name of Taku Te Whiras.
Tēnā koe, Te Pika. What evidence, if any, does she have that reintroducing three strikes legislation will reduce crime in Aotearoa?
Honourable Nicole McKee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Ministry of Justice has previously produced an evidence brief suggesting that reintroducing the three strikes legislation in New Zealand has the potential to reduce crime. US studies on similar laws have shown reductions in both minor and serious violent crimes, along with decreased arrest rates among offenders with previous strikes. The tougher sentences for offending that this regime will introduce for second and third strike offenders will ultimately keep serious, repeat, violent and sexual offenders off the street and prevent them from victimising more New Zealanders, including Māori.
Supplementary. What is her response to the 2018 report by then Prime Minister Bill English, which called out Aotearoa's high rates of incarceration for being based on dogma, not evidence, and criticised policies such as three strikes for being a retributive rather than restorative approach to justice to crime, based on unsupported claims that prisons can solve the problem of crime?
Mr. Speaker, my response to that report is that we have made constructive changes to the regime that will be implemented to ensure that those serious, repeat, violent, sexual offenders are off our streets and our communities are safe. And the reason for that, Mr. Speaker, is because this government is committed to restoring law and order to our communities.
Supplementary.
Taku de Ferris.
Does she accept the findings from research from the United States in 2022, where this law was modelled from, that showed three strikes has no measurable deterrent effect, that it disproportionately locked up African Americans, and that it had no impact on lowering crime rates at all?
Mr. Speaker, the Ministry of Justice has previously produced an evidence brief which cited US studies showing similar three-strike laws have reduced serious violent crimes and reduced arrest rates for offenders who had received a first or second strike. And I think what is really important here, Mr. Speaker, is that we have taken learnings from the previous regime and we will be introducing a new regime which goes about making sure that our communities are kept safe.
Supplementary.
Taku de Ferris. And listen, excuse me, just wait for the quiet. Where you go.
Tēnā koe, te piko. What is her response to the unequivocal majority, the 99% of submitters at select committee, who represented most of the law associations of this country, that this bill is not fit to be passed into the House, should be done away with and something new put in place?
Mr. Speaker, I invite those people, when they actually see the bill, once it's produced, to use the Select Committee process to give us their new version of what they think about it.
Supplementary.
Todd Stevenson.
Have we seen an increase
in... Questions will be asked in silence.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Well, actually, no, the question, you can be audible, but everyone else...
My sign language is not very good.
Just wait, we'll go quiet.
Have we seen an increase in violent crime justifying the need for a new three-strikes regime?
Well, Mr. Speaker, yes, we have. Since Labor came into power, we had seen a 33% increase in violent crime, resulting in an increased number of victimisations. The new and improved three strikes regime will hold serious, repeat, violent and sexual offenders to account, get them off the street and prevent more Kiwis from becoming victims of crime.
Supplementary. What is the Minister's intention with the three strikes policy?
Mr. Speaker, to restore law and order by getting repeat violent and sexual offenders off the streets. We're sending a message to the criminals, Mr. Speaker. Think twice. Because if you commit a violence or sexual offence, you're going to be going away for longer.
Supplementary question, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Is it the Minister and the Government's position that the greatest proportion of victims of violent crime are Maori, and rather than make a sociological example, we're going to do something about it?
Mr. Speaker, yes. Regardless of who a person is, if they commit a serious sexual or violent offence, they are going to be locked up. But what we do need to take into account is the disproportionate portion of Māori and Pacifica people who are victims of crime. And it's very disappointing to see representatives from Te Pāti Māori not even speaking about the victims of crime, but more about cuddling and cotton wooling those criminals instead.
Question number three, in the name of Dana Kirkpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What challenges has she faced in putting together this year's budget?
Well, Mr. Speaker, about this, aside from the state of the economy that was left to us...
Hang on. I think just tone it down just a little bit. Actually, quite a bit. And similarly over here. That's right, the person in front of you.
As I pointed out in the budget policy statement, one of the biggest challenges for this year's budget is that the previous government left behind multiple initiatives with time-limited funding that was about to expire. At the half-year update in December, Treasury identified 9 instances of these fiscal cliffs, where in each case the costs of continuing funding were $100 million more over the forecast period. Mr. Speaker, fiscal cliffs made the future fiscal track look superficially better, but this practice was misleading and left any incoming government facing very difficult funding decisions.
Supplementary, what is the biggest fiscal cliff the government has faced?
Mr. Speaker, the biggest fiscal cliff in Budget 2024 was time-limited funding for Pharmac. The previous government gave Pharmac additional funding of $350 million for 23-24 fiscal year to purchase new medicines and widen access to some that were already funded. But this expires on the 30th of June, and there was no funding set aside for future years. My colleague David Seymour announced on Monday that Budget 2024 will extend this additional funding and, critically, Mr. Speaker, make it permanent. And that will be welcome news to people who rely on these medicines. But we have had to find the $1.77 billion cost of this from within our operating allowance because the previous government did not put 1 cent towards it.
The Honourable David Seymour.
Can the Minister confirm that official advice to ministers from Pharmac is that had the pre-existing budgeting been applied, Pharmac would have needed to delist medicines that New Zealanders had every expectation of receiving but had had no money put aside for under the previous government?
Well, Mr. Speaker, yes, I can confirm
Very well.
That, and I will recall vividly...
Point of order, right on Chris Hopkins.
I've just been contemplating the member's question. He's actually asking a hypothetical question about what would have happened under a re-elected government, what a re-elected government may have done. The current minister has no responsibility for what a re-elected alternative government may have done.
That is a very good point. I was actually listening to the question and starting to think along those lines, but I think the question could be asked in a different way. And as long as it's relatively brief, how about giving that a go?
May I speak to the point of order?
I've just ruled on it.
Well, I may be able to clarify with the intention behind the question.
No, Mr. Speaker. Have another go at the question, first.
Well, with pleasure. To the Minister, can she confirm that under the fiscal track that was set for this government, after it assumed office, it received advice from Pharmac that if it didn't fill in the fiscal cliff for medicine funding, that it would have to delist medicines that New Zealanders relied upon, because the fiscal track, the budgeting that this government inherited had not put money aside to pay for them.
The question was good up to advice.
Mr Speaker, one of the meetings I will recall vividly for the rest of my political career is one that I attended with Minister Seymour, where we asked health officials and Pharmac officials how New Zealand could possibly be in a position where they were saying to us that unless we found $1.77 billion, they would be forced to start delisting essential medicines upon which New Zealand relied. And I remember that meeting vividly, because what I saw in the eyes of their officials was what I felt, which was abject horror at the situation the previous government was prepared to leave Pharmac in.
Dana Kirkpatrick.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. What reaction has the Minister seen to this announcement?
Well, Mr Speaker, I have seen one commentator, who should know better, describe this $1.77 billion commitment to continue funding much-needed medicines as, quote, fiscal jiggery-pokery, quote. Personally, I would reserve the term fiscal jiggery-pokery to describe the practice of funding medicines for 1 year only and then taking it away again. And I think that is being highly misleading to New Zealand, and I would expect much better from the Labor health spokesperson, Ayesha Birrell.
A point of order, Honourable Chris Hipkins.
I wonder whether you could indicate to us where the ministerial responsibility for that last answer lies.
Well, you have to go to the question itself, which was... Sorry, it just slips my mind for a minute. But the response... I'll tell you what, I'm going to have to look at it and afterwards. Sorry about that.
But to the point of order, Mr Speaker. The question was absolutely in order. Ministers aren't responsible for the questions that they are asked. They're absolutely responsible for the answers that they give. And Nicola Willis has a repeated history of giving answers that had fly directly in the face of the rulings that you have given repeatedly since you took up your tenure as Speaker. I suspect, but she's also very clever, because she puts the dig in right in the last few words. Mr Speaker, I think there should be some ability for the member who's the subject of the answer to ask questions in response to that.
It's a novel idea. And actually is, interestingly, the whole purpose of question time. So the opposition will organise their supplementaries to obviously give effect to that. But what I can say is that I do look at question time. It's not an easy thing to, day after day, watch question time twice. But but I do so where there are particularly questions that are under question from the opposition, largely to see if... just where the lines are of straying beyond being able to refer to something that related to the previous government that was inherited, as opposed to a straight-out political attack. I'll continue to do that, and I'll look at this particular question in that regard. But because we're all going to play nice, Ayesha Birrell can have one extra supplementary.
Me?
Yeah, that's how we roll here. Point of order.
Mr Speaker, if you're going to go away and consider this matter, could I just suggest that one of the marvellous things about a democracy is robust debate. And if people can't be prepared to ask to put other sides of the story or hear other people out, I just want to shout in the way that's happening now, then this Parliament will deteriorate very rapidly. It's got a long tradition of people being able to put their points at question time or into speech time, and they've got a whole lot of sensitive people over there that needs to just... harden up. Yeah.
One. Well, thank you for that advice. I'm sure the whole House will take it on. Dr. Ayesha Birrell.
Mr Speaker, supplementary question to the Minister of Finance. Can she assure the House, given her outrage over what she describes as fiscal cliffs, that all items in her budget will be baselined?
Well, Mr Speaker, thank you for the question. In addition to filling in the vast fiscal cliffs left to us by the previous government, in our budget, there will be a very few cases where funding will be time limited. The difference, Mr Speaker, and they could learn from the answer. The difference, Mr. Speaker, is that... The difference, Mr. Speaker, is that in those cases, a review is being undertaken before Cabinet makes a permanent decision. We will be upfront and transparent about these decisions. There will be no hidden fiscal cliffs established for a future government to deal with, and there will be never, under this government's watch, a fiscal cliff left for essential medicines. Shame on you.
Yeah, but you forget I'm Catholic, so I'm very guilty all the time.
Supplementary.
Dan Kirkpatrick.
Will Budget 2024 establish any fiscal cliffs?
I think the member for her question, it seems that her and Ayesha Vero are great minds thinking alike today. And as I said, Mr. Speaker, we are going to be upfront and transparent in our budget. There will be important cases where we will ensure that a review is undertaken before we commit to baselining funding, for the very good reason that, as I've said to this House many times, we are a government that is committed to fiscal discipline on value for money and ensuring that where we commit New Zealand taxpayer money permanently into the future, we can first assure New Zealanders that we know that dollar is going to its best purpose.
Question number 4, in the name of the Honourable Barbara Edmonds.
Malo Albito, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Finance, does she stand by her commitment to deliver meaningful tax cuts for New Zealanders? If so, will she guarantee that every New Zealander will be better off under her budget?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes. In answer to the second part, many factors affect New Zealanders' wellbeing, not just a government budget, which the member seems to imply is the only way New Zealanders can be better off. I can tell the member, however, that we will be putting in more money to improve health services in this budget. We will be putting in more money to improve education. And we will be putting in more money to strengthen law and order. Better public services and tax relief for hard-working Kiwis will help improve people's wellbeing and help them get ahead. But, Mr. Speaker, there is a catch. New Zealanders who commit violent crime, they'll be worse off under our budget.
Supplementary. How will the additional 12,000 New Zealanders who are now unemployed, according to today's unemployment figures, benefit from the tax cuts and be better off in budget 2024?
Mr. Speaker, all New Zealanders benefit from a strong economy, and we as a government are embarking on a significant project to rebuild an economy that has been drastically weakened by a period of prolonged, very high inflation that has eroded people's real incomes and purchasing power, that has led to a significant increase in interest rates, that is in turn leading to 4 of the past 5 quarters having been in recession and very challenging economic conditions. That is the reality we are faced with. It is difficult for many New Zealanders. Our job is to get on with delivering the plan to rebuild our economy, and that is what our budget will do.
It's a long way to say nothing.
Supplementary. Will the increasing number of New Zealanders who are struggling with increases in insurance premiums and higher rates that are significantly outstripping inflation be better off in budget 2024?
Mr. Speaker, this is a novel new policy from the Labor Party today. They're going to be subsidising everyone's insurance bill, I see.
No, that is an out of order answer.
It was a completely legitimate question, and the Minister should actually answer it.
Yeah. I think without referring to another party's policy would be a good idea.
Well Mr. Speaker, it is the position of our government that the best thing that we can do is allow people to keep more of their own money so that they can make choices about how they spend that money.
Supplementary. Will she be the only New Zealander better off by saving her own job ahead of the jobs of frontline workers?
Well,
Mr. Speaker,
just a minute. You've got to say that's in the line of your requests about answers, that question probably is the opposite mirror image of it. But if the Minister wants to comment, she may, otherwise it's not necessary.
Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised by that question. I've actually been giving the opposition member the benefit of the doubt, and that question was well beneath her, and I'm not going to honour it with an answer.
Supplementary. Does she understand that a Minister of Finance, she is responsible for the choices she makes that are causing these deteriorating economic conditions?
Mr. Speaker, I fully and solemnly understand the responsibility we in this government have for the choices we make. And I would point that member to the colleagues either side of her on that front bench who actively chose not to adjust tax thresholds even while inflation ate away at people's incomes, who actively chose to pour fuel on the inflation fire while a cost of living crisis surged, who actively chose to spend money on a TVNZ and RNZ merger when New Zealanders couldn't pay for their groceries. Take responsibility for your own choices as a party, and I'll take responsibility for mine every day of the week.
We ready? The Honourable Marama Davidson, question number 5.
To the Minister responsible for RMA reform, does he agree with the Prime Minister that, quote, no projects have been selected yet for the fast-track process? If so, will he commit to providing an opportunity for public scrutiny of the projects when they are selected for Part A of Schedule 2 of the Fast Track Approvals Bill?
Mr. Speaker, in response to the first part of the question, yes. As we said a number of times, both publicly and in the House, no projects have been selected for the Fast Track process. Cabinet's made a decision to set up a thorough and independent panel process for the selection of projects to be included in the schedule of the bill. In regard to the second part of the question, the public currently has the ability to submit the Select Committee considering the bill. Parliament will have the opportunity to consider the projects in the schedule of the bill. Well, you might be interested, the member might be interested to know we have based the process on the COVID-19 fast-track legislation introduced by the previous government, in which Cabinet delegated decision-making for what projects were to be listed in the bill upon introduction to David Parker. These decisions were made without any public consultation prior to the Select Committee.
Has he received any advice about options for providing public scrutiny of projects to be listed in the legislation? And if so, what was that advice?
Not currently.
Does he stand by a statement, we're open to constructive changes on the fast-track regime to ameliorate some of the concerns that people have, end quote? And if so, will he support sending the bill back to the Select Committee to allow for scrutiny of projects?
Yes, and in relation to the second part of the question, no.
Did he check with any of his Cabinet colleagues about potential or perceived conflicts of interest before deciding to send the letter on April 3rd on the Fast Track Bill?
Mr. Speaker, the member, like others in her party, has made much of a courtesy form letter that went to 200 organisations, some of whom are interested in Fast Track, some of whom are not interested in Fast Track. So writing a letter to someone, which is essentially a press release, letting them know that the fast track process is open, does not raise any concerns that, like the member is raising.
This is also, excuse me, I'll speak for a minute. I just want to make it clear that this House is not a place for speculative accusations. It's not a place for making general statements in the nature of an accusation. Standing orders deal with that very, very clearly, and I will act on them. I think that line of questioning has been well and truly dealt with over a period of 2 days, and it should now cease unless there is a specific action that is part of what is publicly known.
Supplementary.
Right, Honourable Winston-Peters.
Can I ask the Minister not to be speculative in this case? Is it a fact that no member or minister or party in the government has taken $350,000 illegally from a charity as is the fact publicly known now?
I think in interest of progressing, the point's made and no further comment.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Marama Davidson.
Was he made aware of a conflict of interest by Minister Jones, which disclosed $50,000 was donated to New Zealand First from entities with a connection to King's Quarry before he sent the April 3rd letter inviting King's Quarry to apply for the fast track process?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not accepting that question.
Point of order.
I'll tell you why I'm not accepting it. Because there are general activities that a government engages in. If, for example, the Ministry, Conservation Ministry or the Environment Ministry sent out a form letter relating to some particular policy, would the expectation be that a party that might have received some funding from one of the organisations receiving that form letter should cause all of their members to disclose? I think there are clear rules around disclosure. There are clear rules around Cabinet pecuniary interests, and I think trying to pursue it in a general way in which is sort of like a what's the term where you just go please I'll come up with a term where you're just digging around to try and find something is not an acceptable use of the House's time or House procedure.
Speaking to your ruling,
point of
Mr.
order,
Speaker?
The Honourable James Shaw.
Mr. Speaker, in the previous Parliament, I remember a whole series of questions that came from the then opposition where they would ask the same question every day. I'm thinking, for example, of the Honourable Mark Mitchell's questions of police ministers about, you know, crimes on reported on one date versus a number of crimes reported on another date. And the same question was essentially asked week after week after week. And there has never been an attempt by the Speaker to rein in what questions could be asked just because those questions had already been asked and the House had already been informed of those answers. So,
well, I would agree with you. If that were the case, it would be appalling. What I'm ruling on is the content. It's quite a different matter. And I'm happy to discuss it with anybody who likes in the context of standing orders. Supplementary, the Honourable Marama Davidson.
Will he commit to reducing the concentration of powers in ministers under the bill after concerns were raised by the Auditor-General and the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment about the proposed decision-making approach?
Well, the bill, Mr. Speaker, the bill is currently before the Select Committee and we'll be interested to see what the Select Committee reports back. But as I've said publicly, we're open to sensible changes. As indeed all governments are when bill goes through select committees. So we're open to sensible changes, but I can tell the House one thing, or two things. The core of it will remain. It will be a one-stop-shop process in which all of the relevant permits are dealt with at the same time, and it will be a genuine fast-track process. The clue's in the name.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Well, just wait till everyone's quiet.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Are there other examples of fast-track proposals operating in a similar way to what the Minister is proposing?
Be a bit careful here.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I just wanted to make the point, which is that we have taken much of the architecture for the fast-track approvals bill before the Parliament from previous regimes. For example, during the COVID era, a bill was introduced which advanced 17 projects, included upon introduction, added by Cabinet without any public consultation, without anyone even knowing what the projects were until they were dropped in the Parliament. We are actually going through an independent process to provide advice to the government about what projects should be in the bill after it gets reported back from the Select Committee.
It's completely true.
Good. Yeah. Can I... It's a fascinating little exchange. You should take it outside, perhaps even record it. Question number six, the name of Mike Buttram.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister responsible for RMA reform. What announcements has he made regarding reforms to the Resource Management Act 1991?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, last week the Coalition Government announced we're delivering on our commitment to improve resource management laws and give certainty to consent applications, with a bill being introduced to Parliament next month, the bill we're calling Resource Management Amendment Bill No. 1. A number of changes will be included, which includes making it clear that while the National Policy Statement on Freshwater Management is being reviewed and replaced, resource consent applicants no longer need to demonstrate their proposed activities follow the Te Mana o Te Wai hierarchy of obligations. We're amending stock exclusion regulations in relation to sloped land, repealing intensive winter grazing regulations, and suspending the NPSIB requirement for councils to identify new significant natural areas for 3 years.
Mitri. What changes is the government making in this bill to help farmers?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm proud to say this coalition government is ending the war on farmers. The last government loaded on the regulations, putting unnecessary costs on farmers and growers. We're removing the need for resource applicants to demonstrate point their activities order. Follow point the hierarchy order. Of obligations.
A point of order, Honourable Kieran McAnulty.
Mr. Speaker, you've been pretty consistent that questions from government members can't be used not only to attack the previous government, but cast opinions on previous policies. Now, factual statements, fine. Situations of a factual nature that the government has inherited, no problem. But to cast an opinion not only in the first response but also the second sentence of that response should be pulled up.
The trouble was there was a heck of a lot of noise coming and I didn't actually pick up all of what was said, to be quite straight up with you. But can I just suggest that speaking factually about matters that have existed is fine. Being speculative about what those matters were is not so tolerable. So I'll call on the Honourable Chris Bishop to start his answer again.
Mr. Speaker, we're proposing to remove the problematic and contentious low slope map and for regional councils and farmers to determine where stock needs to be excluded based on risk. The focus is on farm level and regionally suitable solutions. These changes, Mr. Speaker, will reduce costs for farmers. It's more work to do, but this is an important first step.
Supplementary. What else does this bill do to help farmers?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, more good news. We're suspending the NPSIB requirement for councils to identify new significant natural areas for 3 years, enabling farmers and growers to find the right solutions for their farm and catchment rather than a dictatorial centralised approach. The criteria for identifying new SNAs were an attempt to provide a standard approach to identifying the most important areas of biodiversity. However, we've heard the concerns of Kiwis that less significant areas are being captured, and this can place too much restriction on how land is used. This change restores property rights to landowners, cuts red tape, and lets farmers and growers get on with what they do best, which is farming.
Supplementary. How do these changes fit in with the government's wider RMA reform agenda?
Mr. Speaker, our RMA reforms have two broad objectives. The first thing is to make it easier to get things done by unlocking capacity for housing and business growth, enabling delivery of quality infrastructure, doubling renewable energy and enabling primary sector growth and development. Our second objective is to safeguard the environment and human health, adapt to climate change and improve regulatory quality in the resource management system. Across the coalition documents making up this multi-party government, there are 20 different commitments relating to the RMA that we are responsible for delivering. As part of phase two, we will be delivering many of those. And of course, the ultimate goal, Mr. Speaker, is to deliver on our phase three commitment to repeal and replace the existing RMA with a new regime premised on the enjoyment of property rights.
Question number 7, in the name of the Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr. Speaker, to the Minister of Māori Development, does he stand by his statement, "I do think people are feeling vulnerable, and that for me is a message that I must be a strong advocate and contributor to Māori success"? If so, does he think cutting jobs at Te Puni Kōkiri is a contributor to Māori success?
Honourable Tama Portuga.
E te maunga o te whare. I am committed to Māori and New Zealand success, and this coalition government is committed to good government. There is a consultation process underway at Te Puni Kōkiri, and that's an operational matter that I'll leave to the Tumu Whakarai of Māori Development to progress.
Mr Speaker, how does prioritising government policies that removes te reo Māori from government departments, removes the treaty provisions in the Oranga Tamariki Act and repeals the Māori Health Authority contribute to Māori success?
It's a māngai te whare. As I said, I remain very committed to being a good example of using te reo Māori in this house and other places. And one thing that I would say is that under the last government, where some of these outcomes went haywire, we saw an increase of 98,000 through to 130,000 Māori on main benefits. And we are committed, supporting Minister Upston and others, to get this country back on track.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister agree with David Seymour that analysis provided by Te Puni Kōkiri is not adding much value? And if so, is this the reason why he is cutting jobs at Te Puni Kōkiri?
E te māngai o te whare. I agree with Minister Seymour, who has observed that having one out of three Māori kids going to school is an absolute failure, and we need to get more Māori children back to school.
Speaker, point of order. Point of order, Mr. Speaker, I don't even believe the Minister's addressed the question. The question was very specific. Does he agree with David Seymour and the analysis provided by Te Puni Kōkiri? He's talking about something completely different, Mr. Speaker. I don't even believe he's addressed the question.
Well, that may be your belief, but when he stood up and said he agrees with David Seymour and then went on to give an example of it, I think that addresses the question. But I'll tell you what, ask it again and see what else he can come up with.
Thanks very much, sir, Mr. Speaker. Come off script. Oh, OK. E whakai ana ia ki tā David Seymour, ko te wete wete a TPK. Kāri te nui haere te wāriu, mēnā koeina te take i tapahia e ia ngā mahi e TPK.
E te māngā te whare. E tino tautoko anau i te kianga kōrero a Minister Seymour, e pēnei ana tōna kōrero. Kore kore noi ho ngā tamariki Māori, haere ana ki ngā kura. Nā reira, me kaha tātou, me pakari tātou, ki te tautoko i era tamariki Māori, kia hoki atu ki te kura.
A supplementary question, the right honourable Winston Peters. Mr. Peters, if you wouldn't mind, sir, we'll just wait for quiet.
Yeah. Does the Minister consider that the questioner's phraseology is more understandable to 95% of New Zealanders than it's ever been in the past?
Tino tautoko.
Can I ask the Minister, what advocacy, if any, has he done to ensure no further cuts to workers across his portfolio responsibilities?
It's a māngai o te whare, as mentioned before. Those matters are in the operational remit of the Tūmuru Whakarai of Māori Development. But what we absolutely focus on are the 9 key government targets, many of which touch on disproportionate impacts on Māori.
Speaker, can I ask, how can he claim he is a strong advocate for Māori success when all Māori are seeing are cuts, repeals and the undermining of kaupapa Māori initiatives?
E te māngai o te whare. Late last year we saw a number of Māori, particularly whānau Māori, who lost their jobs at Duken at Gisborne's timber mill. And Te Puni Kōkiri and others got behind and rallied behind those people and gave them support to retrain and transition out of an unemployment situation into horticulture and construction. That is the mahi that this government is committed to supporting, to getting people back in work and off the main benefits. Kia ora.
Question number 8, the name of Carl Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education and asks, what announcements has she recently made on priorities for education?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Erica Stanford.
Mr. Speaker, this week I announced 6 education priorities which will drive decision-making and build a world-leading education system for New Zealand students. These priorities are establishing a clear year-by-year curriculum that details the knowledge, skills and competencies that kids need to succeed, implementing evidence-based approaches to teaching literacy and numeracy, introducing more consistent reporting, strengthening teacher training and targeting effective learning support and interventions, and using data and evidence to drive decision making. These priorities will support the government to be laser focused on ensuring that at least 80% of our kids are at curriculum by 2030.
Supplementary. Why did she make this announcement?
Mr. Speaker, the persistent trends of decline in achievement and attendance must stop. Our current system, in the words of the Ministry itself, does not deliver excellent or equitable outcomes. Mr. Speaker, the equity gap is stubbornly wide. 20% of our tamariki Māori are at curriculum for maths at the end of year 8. And in 2022, almost 10,000 kids left school with no qualifications at all. My six education priorities represent a bold and significant shift away from an approach that is vague and devolved, away from a pick and mix approach to assessment, and away from a broken learning support system that fails to meet the needs of our students and has delivered poor results. We have a mandate for change and have been elected to deliver a high-performing and internationally comparable education system.
Supplementary. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How will this announcement help to turn around a persistent decline in student achievement?
Mr. Speaker, these priorities will shape the direction of the education system. This work is already underway. From this term, we have targeted regional professional learning and development funding across the country to focus on embedding structured approaches to literacy in both English and Te Reo, developing assessment capabilities and practices, including aramatawai for Māori medium schools, and supporting teachers to prepare students for the numeracy and literacy co-requisites at NCA and Level 1. I am directing investment to the front line, ensuring teachers get the support they need to drive these changes.
Supplementary. How will these priorities support her vision for education?
Mr. Speaker, we are putting ambition and achievement back at the heart of our education system. Your means should not determine your destiny. My vision is not only to lift achievement, but to close the equity gap that has plagued New Zealand society for too long. These priorities laid the foundations for change. Under this government, education and social investment lens will deliver greater social mobility, support breaking intergenerational cycles of poverty, and build the pathways that allow every child to fulfil their potential and to be ambitious about their future.
Question number 9, then over to the Honourable Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Police, what advice, if any, has he received on the safety of frontline police officers?
Mr. Speaker, I receive a... Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, I'm listening. Carry on.
I receive a range of advice. The latest advice that I received from police in relation to frontline safety is that there was a 45.5% increase in assaults on police since 2018.
Does he agree with police advice that, quote, timely and accurate intelligence sharing between the Firearms Safety Authority and police is vital for joint success? Shared intelligence supports frontline staff safety as well as the work of police in tackling organised crime, unquote.
Yes, I do agree with that. I think that we're in a terrible situation as a country. We're under the previous government. We've seen a massive increase in violent crime, a 33% increase. We've seen a 76% increase in gang members. Those gang members are carrying firearms. They're willing to use them. The intelligence for the police to gather is critically important. They are rebuilding that capability. This government is bringing legislation to make sure they've got additional tools and powers to get on top of the gang problem that we've got in our country. This government is committed to making sure that we get back on track and that New Zealand should be the safest place in the world instead of experiencing some of the worst violent crime that was perpetrated by that government or the former government.
Is he confident that frontline police officers will be able to access up-to-date intelligence on firearms if the Firearms Safety Authority is removed from police and located within another government department, such as the Department of Internal Affairs?
Well, what I'd say to that is that this government is committed to making sure that our police have got all the intelligence, all the tools, all the resources that they need to go out there and keep the public safe. They feel that they've got a lot of work to do because under the previous government, we saw an enormous increase in gang members. We've seen a massive increase in violent retail crime that's baked in over 6 years. We've got a big job ahead of us. We're up for it and we're tackling it.
Good answer. Mr. Speaker, I asked the Minister if he is confident whether frontline police safety will be ensured if the transfer of Te Tari Pūriki, the Firearms Safety Authority, is taken out of police. I don't believe he went anywhere near talking about that question.
Well, I'll just have another go, that's all.
Well, again...
No one's in a hurry here, it seems.
Again, Mr... Well, do you want to ask the question again, or do you want me to start?
Well, you've just actually asked the question again by way of your point of order, so I think you've probably heard it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Like I said, this government is committed to making sure that our police have all the resources, all the intelligence and the ability to be able to deal with firearms and gang harm in this country, because under the previous government, we had a 76% increase in gang numbers. We've had a massive increase in gang violence. We've had gang members now that carry firearms and are willing to use them. And this government is committed to making sure that our police officers have got the tools and the powers and the ability to not only keep themselves safe, but keep the members of the public safe as well.
Mr. Speaker, I asked whether the Minister had confidence that the transfer of that authority into another department would ensure frontline safety. He gave me a list of things that he was committed to, but he did not express confidence in shifting the Firearm Safety Authority would ensure that same level of access to intelligence to police.
Yes, I know, but I've listened to the answer twice now, and I think replying in a way that talks about a commitment to the safety of officers does address the question.
Supplementary. How will he resolve police's concern that, quote, both the Arms Act and the Coalition Agreement include timings that appear incompatible with one another, and this needs to be resolved?
Well, there's nothing incompatible at all about the approach to law and order and public safety by this coalition government. We have committed to an additional 500 police officers. We are bringing new legislation in that will deal with violent gangs. We are bringing legislation in that will actually put tougher consequences around these violent retail youth and juvenile offenders. So it is a completely consistent approach by this government in terms of making sure that we start to deal with what's a tough job because of the last 6 years under a Labor government. But we are committed to that. And we're going to continue to make forward movement on it.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I asked him
Hang
whether...
On, what, excuse me.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order.
Apologies, Mr. Speaker, point of order. The Minister was asked that there was a quote that was police advice that basically clearly said that the Arms Act and the Coalition are at odds with each other, and that needs to be resolved. And the Minister has not addressed and how he intends to resolve that issue.
Well, perhaps not the way the member would like, but he started his answer by saying he disagreed with you. I don't think you can get much clearer than that.
Supplementary. How can he say that frontline safety is his priority when police themselves have raised real concerns directly with him regarding taking the Firearm Safety Authority out of police?
Well, I can say that public safety is important to this government because that's what we're about as a coalition. And police safety, if the Minister had read my letter of expectation to the Commissioner, which we had to release to get us back on track and focused again on the things that matter, she would see that police safety is a priority for this government.
Good. We'll now go to question number 10, the name of Tamitha Paul.
Tēnā koe, te māngai. My question is to the Minister for Children. Does she agree with official advice that military-style boot camps are, quote, likely to be detrimental to young people with a history of abuse, end quote, and if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Karen Choi.
First of all, I'd like to say I disagree with the member's interpretation of the advice as asked in the question. If you take the advice as it was stated in full, which said traditional boot camp models of strict discipline are likely to be detrimental to young people with a history of abuse and family violence, yes, I do agree. The advice also noted that programs which include elements of counselling and have primary focus on rehabilitation are significantly more effective. The program that this government is working on will have a military-style component with a rehabilitative and trauma-informed care approach. This is not just about consequences for young people who offend, but actually showing them that they have it within themselves to turn their lives around. It will give them the tools and the encouragement that they need to do so.
Supplementary.
Does she think the 86% reoffending rate of the last military-style activity camps is a sign of success? And if not, why is she repeating this failed experiment that causes traumatised young people more harm?
Mr. Speaker, the military-style academies and the MAC program were run between 2010 and 2016. An evaluation of that program showed positive results with improvements in attitude and motivation of the young people to address their offending. However, it was also found that the lack of robust support once the young person left the program meant that the improvement in outcomes were not realised to the extent that they might have been. That is why the program that this government is working on is going to have a rehabilitative and trauma-informed care approach alongside the military approach to ensure that these young people receive the full wraparound support they need to turn their lives around.
Supplementary. Does she think it's acceptable to experiment on young people when there is a wealth of evidence on what works to reduce youth crime?
Mr. Speaker, what I don't find acceptable is not giving these young people the tools and the care that they need to turn their lives around. We need to make sure that we're giving them everything that they need to know that they are worth something and that they can become the best that they can be.
Supplementary. Why does she expect military-style boot camps to work in Aotearoa this time around when officials advised of numerous international evidence of boot camps being the least effective interventions when it comes to reducing youth reoffending?
March forward.
Mr. Speaker, Oranga Tamariki has received advice, multiple advice from different agencies, looked around to different programs, taken learnings from those programs, what worked, what didn't work, in creating this new program which will make sure that our young people are not out reoffending and causing harm in our communities. This is about reducing harm in our communities and making sure that our young people have the right support behind them.
Supplementary. Can she name a single evidence-based reason as to why she is pursuing military-style boot camps when all of the evidence is stacked against them?
Mr. Speaker, what the evidence does show us is what we are doing now is not working. We can't accept the status quo.
Right.
We need to make sure that we are giving these young people the tools they need to be the best that they can be. And I believe that this government is truly caring about making sure that we are reducing harm within our communities, but also making sure that we are reducing these young people going back into communities without the support that they need to turn their lives around.
Well done.
Question number 11, in the name of Dr. Vanessa Wenner.
To the Minister for Building and Construction, what announcements has the government made in building and construction?
Honourable Chris Peace.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The government is bringing forward a review of earthquake-prone buildings to provide greater certainty for Kiwis. While this review is underway, all current remediation deadlines will be extended by 4 years. Of course, some building owners who have already planned on making improvements will be in a position to continue this work, motivated by considerations such as private insurance arrangements or the ability to tenant buildings. But we have heard in many cases across New Zealand that buildings were not going to be remediated within the original timeframes anyway because of barriers such as crippling cost and heritage status.
Why are these changes needed?
Mr. Speaker, our government is focused on rebuilding the economy. The current earthquake-prone building system was put in place in 2017 in good faith, and required buildings considered to be earthquake-prone to be remediated before set dates. Nearly 500 deadlines are set to expire over the next 4 years. Council and building owners across New Zealand have told me, and other government members, that many buildings will not meet their deadlines due to the costs involved being much higher than originally contemplated, and further complicated by heritage rules and other artificial constraints affecting residential housing.
What impact will these changes have?
Mr. Speaker, these changes from the review, or at least the ones we contemplate will flow from the review, we hope will provide considerable relief across New Zealand. The earthquake-prone building rules impact the entire country, not just Wellington, in small town New Zealand and larger cities alike. Without change, an increasing number of buildings could sit empty and derelict, which would have a devastating effect on the economy across New Zealand, again, in a multitude of different built environments.
What are the next steps?
Mr. Speaker, Cabinet will soon agree to the terms of reference for the review, which will be informed by feedback from a wide range of affected New Zealanders. In addition, a Building Act Amendment Bill will be introduced to give effect to the extension to remediation deadlines.
Question number 12, the name of Glenn Bennett.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Economic Development and asks, does she agree with her statement, quote, "I think we need to get on with the job of delivering for New Zealand," end quote? And if so, what actions has she taken to deliver for New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, yes, as delivering for New Zealand is what this government was elected to do. This government has an ambitious target to deliver to value of exports, to double the value of exports over the next decade, continue to support major events, increase foreign direct investment, and improve the government procurement system by reducing red tape and bureaucracy.
Why did she allow the cancellation of industry transformation plans, given it was a tool to work alongside industry to accelerate the growth and success of New Zealand businesses?
That was a coalition government decision. It was cancelled.
What does she say to the forestry and wood processing sector after their plan was axed, given their overwhelming support for the plan to create high-value jobs and a low-carbon products here in New Zealand?
There are many decisions that this government actually makes, and one of the things that we are trying to do is actually grow the economy. And some of the decisions that that government actually put through was a bad idea, and we cancelled them.
What does she say to members of the tech sector who contribute $13 billion to the New Zealand economy, like NZ Tech, who have publicly asked the minister to, and I quote, "please retain the industry-led, government-supported framework to enable collaboration and alignment across this rapidly growing part of the economy"?
The tech industry is very well supported by this government, and one of the great ministers, Judith Collins, is actually very focused on that.
How can industry sectors have faith in her performance and economic development plan if all they can find is cuts to investment into their industries?
One of the things that we are very focused on, as I said, is that doubling the value of export over the next decade, continue to support major events that bring investment and tourism dollars to the regions, increase foreign direct investment, and improve the government procurement system by reducing red tape and bureaucracy that will get New Zealand back on track. One of the things that I can actually tell that member is that I've been travelling up and down the country, including to his electorate. Well, actually, he's a List member, so it's not his electorate, but in New Plymouth, last week, to hear their concerns and find ways to support them to achieve their economic success.
That brings us to a close of oral questions.